This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. We are going to talk about woodcock banding today with my friends Jerry Havel and Bailey Peterson. We will chat with them in just a moment. A quick shout out to all the Patreon patrons out there. Thank you for your continued support. And I will be drawing the next Patreon giveaway winner in the coming weeks for a one-year subscription to Onyx Elite. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. And one more reminder, you may still have a day or two to sign up for American Woodcock Society, their ongoing membership drive, which they made available to listeners of the Birdshot Podcast as we round out our woodcock-themed month on the podcast. Through the end of the month, March that is, you can migrate to membership by following the link in the show notes of this episode and use the promo code BIRDSHOT24 to get access to the American Woodcock Society membership drive, along with included benefits, depending on which level of membership you sign up for. So today's episode was again sparked by my conversation with the American Woodcock Society and in reading the latest issue of their Covers magazine with the amazing artwork of our good friend Jay Dowd on the cover. I've got it just sitting in my office, been admiring it all month. And in this issue of the RGS AWS magazine, there is an article written by Bailey Peterson, one of our two guests today, all about woodcock banding. So last week we talked GPS tracking with Dr. Eric Blumberg. If you missed that one, go check it out. Always an interesting conversation with Eric and some fascinating tidbits in there about woodcock migration. Today we're talking to Bailey Peterson and Jerry Havel about the predecessor of sorts to GPS tracking, bird banding. And along with it, the included use of pointing dogs to aid in the banding of woodcock and the certification process, requirements, and information about how woodcock banding is done and how to go about getting involved in it yourself if you and your dog are interested. So with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and on to the Birdshot Podcast of Woodcock, Minnesota, Jerry Havel and Bailey Peterson. First things first, I need a puppy update. How's my boy Zeus, Jerry?
Zeus acts like a Bernese Mountain Dog puppy because he's got a brother and a sister. He goes on walks. He put up a grouse yesterday on a walk, which is kind of funny.
Really?
Didn't know what was going on, but he has a mouth and retrieving fetish, and he is a hoarder. He hoards every shoe, dog toy, water bottle, you name it. So Zeus will be, we'll have a good spring with old Zeus.
Does he have a...
Bailey gets to see him in a couple weeks, so.
Yeah. Does he have a preference for Brenda's shoes or your shoes?
Bailey's gonna, right now, it seems to be UGG slippers and UGG boots. So, yeah. But Bailey gets to have them for a couple weeks when I'm gone, and I'm expecting big things from Bailey, the dog trainer.
Yeah, I gotta get my puppy fixed.
Don't you have like a? Do you have any puppies on the way this spring, Bailey?
I'm on an off year.
Okay.
gotta try to hold back a little bit. You can only have so many.
Yeah. So you've got four now, or three?
Yep, four.
Four. What's the youngest one? Osier.
Yeah, Osier. Yep, he's one and a half.
So is Osier certified to woodcock band yet, or was he not there yet last year?
I could test him out this year. I'm not sure if I'm going to or not. I already have three dogs I can use, so no sense in putting a lot of pressure on him, I guess.
Yeah.
He's very steady, naturally steady. I mean, I have some videos of him because the woodcock hung around a bit after the season closed last year, and I do have some video of him holding steady on woodcock without being asked. That's pretty cool to watch him fly right over his head. But yeah.
All right. So we've got like our biggest storm of the year almost behind us. It felt a lot like we were looking ahead to woodcock banding, but then everything's changed in the last 24 hours, and now we're all covered up in snow, which is probably fine because we needed the precipitation. And so woodcock banding, we'll have to wait a little bit. I know we had birds here. Bailey, had you been out running the dogs and seen woodcock before the storm here?
No, I had not. I know they're in the state for a couple weeks already, but I hadn't gotten a chance to get out when the weather was favorable. And last week it was not nice out, so I didn't even try. I don't like to displace them when it's
right.
Too crappy out. But it's like you said, looking ahead, it should be getting better, and it's better that it happened now. It seems like this happens every spring, and my concern always is that they're going to be sitting on eggs when this
right.
prolonged wet heavy snow comes, and they'll sit it out as long as they can, but it does lead to abandonments or failed nesting, so when it happens too late, or it can. So I'm happy that it's now, because I think it was a bit early yet.
And mostly these are probably males, don't you think, Bailey? These early ones, these early.
Well, I think so.
I had a couple at Pine Ridge, so
I think so. And that's sort of what the like GPS collared birds it tell us is back. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, the males tend to be the first to arrive and set up, and then wait for the females to come. I don't know if you caught the episode I did with Eric Blumberg last week, but he was commenting about how they've started to see that the hens would and male they would basically reproduce sort of on their way up, and they saw like multiple nesting attempts from a single hen as she moved to the north. Thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I can't say I'm surprised. I've been out looking for woodcock before well into the nesting season, where it should be getting close to the brood rearing season. And one year I was just finding random eggs out on like the edges of covers. And I thought that it was so strange, like just to be seeing one egg. And I didn't figure that like a squirrel deposited on like the edge of a field. I just thought that they must have just kind of dumped. They were ready to produce an egg, and then, but they weren't ready to nest yet for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So they just deposited it and moved on, or took shelter, or whatever the situation was. But you know, one year I found just probably five random eggs just out and about.
So really?
It was pretty weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like you said, I think as it's sort of like we had this non-winter and it felt like it was going to be an early spring, I'm kind of for various reasons, not only woodcock and woodcock banding, but I'm okay with it not greening up and warming up entirely yet. I think this will kind of set the timeline right if we really do kind of continue on with our spring after this little winter hiatus.
Yeah, I agree. I was getting nervous about the turkeys. We had four wildfires in one day over here, and I was just really worried about that becoming a trend. So I'm really pretty happy about this weather, even though it kind of stinks right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we need the moisture. That's the biggest thing. I mean, the woods, it's pretty dry, and like Bailey said, the wildfires. But, I mean, there's a lot of little ponds and stuff that I haven't seen empty in 20 years, and they're empty.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hopefully we'll get some moisture, have a little dry spell, and get some more this summer.
What were your comment on turkeys, Bailey? What were you thinking there? What were you worried about?
Well, that's a selfish concern, because the hunting season wasn't going to be open for another month yet.
And, okay. All right.
I didn't want their behavior. You know, sometimes my turkey season will conflict a little bit with woodcock banding, and so woodcock banding is my priority personally.
Yeah.
But I really do like to turkey hunt, and so if they could not overlap, that's ideal. So and then I just didn't want the turkey behavior to be altered, and I talked to some folks who said the lack of snow won't affect it, but judging by social media pictures and videos folks have been posting, it really I wasn't so sure about that.
Right.
Emily seemed to be pretty keyed up.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one that is thinking that, because that's what I was thinking too with the early spring and just wanting things to line up. And I've got a family vacation coming up here too, but I was hearing the same thing and seeing strutting toms and stuff from people down in the Twin Cities. And I was talking to Ryan Sparks from Quill Forever. He's a big turkey hunter, and he was kind of, his thought on it at the time was, this was back in early March, I guess. He was just, you know, if it's a bright blue sunny sky day, he's like, turkeys are going to go out and strut, and that's what they're going to do. But it's probably not going to throw everything off in the spring. But boy, it sure felt like turkey hunting conditions the last couple of weeks.
It did. I don't need it to be like, I don't need to shoot one the first minute of the first
right
day of the season, but it's it makes it harder to predict which for our season structure where you have to pick a season to pick which one to go when you think that they might be like henned up in your area. So
yeah, totally. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about woodcock banding. I've kind of been mentioning on the podcast, we sort of have this woodcock theme going in the month of March, and we talked GPS research with Eric Blumberg last week, and so I thought I would get some of the banding folks on this week to kind of round out the episode and set us up for spring. I guess actually before we get into that, Jerry, I don't want to overlook a key member and piece of the woodcock banding program in Minnesota, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, Earl the Pearl Johnson. I mentioned it on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. It's a big loss for the upland community and certainly the woodcock banding community. And I know he was a good friend of yours, Jerry, and yours, Bailey, and a long time fixture up at Pine Ridge. Sad to see him go, Jer.
Yeah, it was. Mother Nature in the woods and in life can't stop the inevitable. Earl kind of read the program back in the early 90s, late 80s, when it was kind of dying, basically dead, I would have to say. And he kind of upstarted it with another friend that's passed away, Donna Dustin.
Yep.
Got it going and, you know, made some changes and, if you were around Earl with the infectious smile, you wanted to be a part of stuff or something. And woodcock banding, he got a lot of people interested. He trained a lot of people, and again, got people excited about this quirky little bird that I know Bailey and I love. He was a big mentor to me and a lot of other people in the woodcock banding community, but also, you know, in the conservation and stewardship community that Earl was very active in. And in fact, I'll let Bailey talk about it, but we're going to do some stuff with the Minnesota Sharptail Society here. Bailey, want to kind of comment on that? That kind of goes along with what we're talking about.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just I don't even know what annual. So I'll just say the annual longstanding meeting with the annual meeting of the Minnesota Sharptail Grouse Society and the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society. And we were contacted.
And Earl was very active in both of those.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I just found out today, actually, that he was hard at work on one of his famous belt buckles for the prairie chicken. He used to carve. It was amazing. He'd carve like a prairie chicken on a lek kind of scene out of like the end of an antler and turn it into a belt buckle. It was pretty cool, and he did a few of those a year and always donated them to like the silent auctions and things like that. But this was an event that he like didn't ever miss, and so we had been contacted if we wanted to be a sponsor of that particular workshop coming up in mid-April. And so we just decided as a group to go ahead with that and in memorial of Earl. But yeah, as Woodcock Minnesota as a group, we still have yet to kind of get together and discuss what more we want to do. I mean, he deserves a lot for all the work he put in. So maybe someday there'll be a Earl Johnson Memorial Singing Ground Maintained Wildlife opening or something like that. We'll put a little bench out there for him.
Yeah, just to add on fantastic. To that, you know, not just a woodcock, but, you know, Earl contributed a lot of ways, not only to the Rough Grouse Society and, you know, the cover dog world, the trials, but you know, here at Pine Ridge, man, he was a mentor for a lot of people. The outpouring when I kind of sent the note out to some of our guests here at Pine Ridge, you know, it was nothing but stories. And when Earl lost a dog, or when Earl dropped a tree in the bunkhouse, or, you know, the Lars song that Kevin used to write. I mean, there were a lot of great memories on the banding and at Pine Ridge, and I'm sure with the Prairie Chickens and the Sharptail. I mean, he was just one of those people that that it was an honor to be a part of and to know. So now I'll end it on that.
Yeah, he had an infectious personality, and as you pointed out, he loved to share it. And he was, you know, again, I can speak to it from my perspective. When I first started coming out to Pine Ridge and hanging out there, I mean, it was like Earl was kind of synonymous, like, oh, well, this is a, you know, dyed in the wool bird dog, bird hunter, you know, this is the guy. I probably had him as the figurehead of Pine Ridge more so than Jerry in those early days.
That's fine.
Yeah. But.
Well, the best was the one of my favorites at the bar. He'd pull out his raccoon toothpick. And
I mentioned that you passed you.
He would pick all these people from the South, you know, all these quail guys, and, you know, all prim and proper. And Earl would bring out his raccoon toothpick and bet him what it actually was. And he'd win a drink or a $5 bill or something. But there's 100 more little stories like that. But down deep, his heart was really into conservation. And I mean, I'm sure he loved the other birds, but there was a story. We were doing a Woodcock, Minnesota event really early on, and it was real early, and Earl got so passionate about the study that him and Kyle were doing that he literally was in tears about the mink eating the woodcock chicks that they had just banded. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and he took it so to heart about that, you know, the how hard they worked to get those chicks radioed, and then here this mink comes, and I mean, he literally was shedding tears over these baby chicks. And, you know, that just says a lot. I mean, how much passion he had for upland hunting and the upland birds that he came in contact with. So yeah, it was a big loss, but, you know, in his memory, I think a lot of people will do some special things next couple of years in his name. So that'll be cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely heard it from a good cross section of the listeners, you know, knowing that a lot of folks have been to Pine Ridge, listened to the show, but there were a lot of people that reached out and appreciated the mention and just wanted to kind of send their regards. So yeah, he will be missed, but absolutely not forgotten. And his impact will live on. That's for dang sure. Jerry, when did you and Pine Ridge really get involved in woodcock banding?
You know, it's funny. So Woodcock, Minnesota has been around for a while. I want to say about 15 years. A group of guys, they were a little upset with the lack of attention another organization was giving. So they created Woodcock, Minnesota as a 501c3. Gertz was one of them, Trevor Sumption, a couple other guys. And my dad was one, Earl was one, Steve Wild was one. Mm. And they did a lot. They started off raising some money and doing some habitat work. A lot of it in Finlayson County, some up by Tamarack. They helped fund Kyle Daly's research program. They did a lot of work with Dave Anderson. So these are the early years. And then it just kind of, as organizations kind of grow, you know, things kind of, people get busy, people retire. So it was kind of, I don't want to say it was status quo mode, but it was really, what are we going to do? So Bailey and I and God, Terry, a couple other people, we just kind of rejuvenated it and said, hey, we'll take it over. And that was probably about 8-9 years ago, I think, Bailey. And basically said, you know what, we've got people that are interested in doing something and giving back, and let's make woodcock banding kind of the main focus of Woodcock, Minnesota, instead of trying to raise money and do some of the habitat work that they did in the past. We kind of switched focus, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bailey, but the mission for Woodcock Minnesota kind of changed to being having an active, trained, and certified volunteer group of citizens, people, with certified dogs to help in research projects and other science projects for the betterment of Woodcock. That's pretty much our mission statement, correct, Bailey?
Right, yep, pretty close.
Yep, so we took that, and we did new articles of incorporation, and we kind of changed some of the certification tests. And to be really honest, we actually put a lot of meat back into it. Before, it was kind of, oh, yeah, your dog's pretty good, or you're holding the bird okay. But Debbie and Debbie Peterson, Lindsay Chartel, Dr. Worm, we call, Bailey, really those three really took the lead and developed a really, really intensive handbook on the proper way to do these things. And with that, we had some credibility to the point where we have other people asking to use our book, use some of the stuff that we had to put some more rules and regulations,
criteria,
but more rules into how to certify a dog, how to band a chick correctly, how to hold it, how to release it. I mean, stay away from the hen. And the big thing was the dogs, but Bailey, Lindsay, and Debbie did a lot of work on that. And then Kyle Daly, Kyle, obviously you've had Kyle on, and Kyle did his research on woodcock chick or survival rate. So Kyle has a good relationship with the banding lab. And what happened is, well, we used to have the permit with the Minnesota DNR, which was fine, but we thought it might be a little bit better to have our own. So Kyle has a banding permit that he can sublet to banders that are approved. And we just got approval to expand what we're doing in Minnesota to Wisconsin. We have a lot of Wisconsin people come over for our program. And now we're going to run our first test, our first certifying test in Wisconsin, to have an active trained group of citizens with certified dogs abandoned woodcock. So that's kind of where we're at there with kind of the evolution of Woodcock Minnesota. We're a small group, but again, with Earl and Donna, who, like I said, we've talked both about previously, we're pretty dedicated. And then Pine Ridge, we base out of here because we can do all the dog stuff here, the training here. We've got the singing grounds here. We've got the whole area of the Chippewa National Forest to ban. So it works out pretty good. But I'll let Bailey kind of talk about that expansion to Wisconsin, because that is a really big deal. So I'll transfer that over to Bailey.
Sure, thanks. So Minnesota's program, that's okay. Minnesota's program started, like the volunteer banding program started, like Jerry said, under the Minnesota DNR umbrella back in the, I think, mid-90s officially. And there was a really solid core group of people. It was a little bit like the Wild West, but there was a solid group of banders modeled off of the Michigan banding program, which is longer standing and a larger program. And that group of people, basically they kind of aged out without gaining a lot of new banders. And the interest grew exponentially once we started hosting the clinic at Pine Ridge and through the powers of social media. The need to have the handbook and the rules and restrictions and all those things that are there, it may seem like a barrier, but it's really, really good that they exist. And our program in Minnesota has been growing every year. And so we have a great amount of interest annually. Workshop fills up every year. But every year we get the folks from Wisconsin that are so interested, but they didn't have a program over there. They're sort of in the middle of two states that do have programs. And so since we were no longer under the umbrella of the Minnesota DNR, we were able to be a little bit more flexible in the federal permit that we had. You can add additional states to it. And so we reached out to the bird banding lab down in Maryland, and Wisconsin DNR wrote us a letter of support to get on their permit. And this will be the first year that we have an official banding clinic in the state of Wisconsin. Last year, we did have banders from Wisconsin come to our Minnesota clinic at Pine Ridge. And we did have, I think, 5 different banders successfully band about 30 chicks in Wisconsin last year. So that was pretty cool. So I think that program will also grow greatly as we kind of get some things figured out. There are some logistical challenges in Wisconsin that, since it's a new state for us to be in, have some things that we need to work through still. But we're figuring those out. And we are hosting our first clinic, like I said, May 10th through 12th, up in Solon Springs, Wisconsin. Oh, it's okay. Almost full. I think it's almost full. I might be able to take a couple more people.
And they'll go through the handbook and the program that we've kind of outlaid here. That's been very, very, you know, again, like Bailey said, it's a big handbook or Google Doc drive. It's really, I'll give credit to the other people. It's really an awesome in-depth of how to band, what your dog needs to do to band correctly, and really everything's geared toward the chicks and the survival of the chicks. And it's a pretty cool deal. You know, and one of the things that I think Woodcock, Minnesota has done is I know Debbie's done some stuff with outfit at Duluth, putting Telemet radio collars on it, some new GPS. And then two, we've helped with tests last year. Bailey's my resident biology. When I talk about biology and birds, I just regurgitate what I hear from Bailey. So, but we helped a guy, a professor down in Kansas with I always say woodcock poop survey, but that's another thing that the band that we did with banders is we collected, when we banded chicks, we collected woodcock chalk, and he did some DNA on it. But it really is exciting to have our program grow a little bit, and try to provide. And I do want to say this is not a dog training program for people. This really is a citizen science type program. Yep. Where we're the goal is not to take Zeus, my young puppy, out and band woodcock. We've done a really good job of trying to eliminate that scenario for people. This is a dog like for Bailey's got Mogul, who's a stud. You know, we want dogs that are steady to wing, that are basically great bird dogs to provide, you know, because, you know, the quiet period is April 15th, and, you know, we have permits that can run after that. So we don't want to have non-trained dogs out in the woods at that time. But we're pretty proud of it. And now the Wisconsin programs, it's going to help it grow more and more. You want to add on that, Bailey? Yeah. I know I forgot something on that, but...
No, you were good. The goal is just to be... We want to have very trustworthy dogs that can easily transition to, any other project we may be asked to help with. So we've been... I think it's 3 or 4 different university studies on woodcock that we've been able to help with since I've been doing this. And then there's... the spruce grouse research project I talked about before that we were able to easily transition to just because we had dogs that were already trained to a certain standard. And so for Wisconsin, that's kind of the goal, to be, be able to mobilize the same kind of group of people. So our dogs are trained to a set standard. They're tested individually at the certification portion of the banding workshop. That's just to get you permission to run them under the supervision of a mentor during your apprenticeship. Maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but that's sort of how it works. And then each apprentice is what you're called an apprentice once you attend the banding workshop with the intention to become a certified or permitted woodcock bander. And so then a lot of people reach out to us ahead of the workshop to see what to work on and what the test might entail. And, we'll give a little bit of details, but essentially the dog needs to be studied through the flush and the fall, which is what you'd call it after, you know, like a shot and fall. But since the bird isn't being shot, we eliminate the shot and we still require to be steady to the fall, because what a hen woodcock does is, you know, she'll do what we call a flutter flight. She'll flush a very short distance, sometimes only, you know, 5 to 10 yards. And then she may like flop around a little bit and pretend like she has a broken wing or struggling with like inability to walk. She may be making a distraction noise. They all do things a little bit differently, but it all boils down to she put a ton of energy into raising up this brood, and she is, you know, more apt to draw the predator away since she can fly, even though it doesn't look like she can when she's doing this display. But the point is to draw the predator away, and that's no different than what she does to our dogs when we have them pointing these hen woodcocks with their broods. And so we have a whole process on how we encounter a brood, but just saying that these dogs need to be certified to a very specific level to withstand that high level of pressure and temptation. Yes.
Yeah.
And so we have developed a new bander checklist that's I think it's like 5 pages of tasks that a mentor needs to check off before an apprentice can get approved to go out banding on their own. And it's really just to make sure that the new bander feels comfortable and has encountered various scenarios that we would commonly encounter. It just takes a lot of time sometimes to get through this stuff, but it is, you know, down to our mission statement about it's all about the birds and the bird welfare. So it's important.
You guys hit on a lot of stuff there. And there are a couple of things I wanted to highlight. One, as I was reading your article in the Covers magazine, Bailey, kind of, and you guys have both mentioned it, the citizen science aspect of this, which I think is what, you know, it makes it obviously very unique. What other types of citizen science things are there? Like, would you compare woodcock banding to anything else? What other sort of opportunities like this exist? Now, we've definitely talked about a few. You mentioned the spruce grouse study. I was recently interviewed somebody out in Utah that's doing, they're starting to use some pointing dogs for forest grouse research out there. But are there any other like real noteworthy citizen science applications kind of like this, Bailey?
I believe the state of Alaska does have a core group of people doing ptarmigan like surveys. I don't know how they're structured, but I do know a few guys that go out and do that, which is cool. And then I do think that there is a Western state, and I don't know which one, that does have a little bit of work, or maybe it was a university study similar to what we've helped with sage grouse. But I don't know if that's an annual study.
Okay. Yeah. And then again, the bird dog side of things, I feel like that, I mean, it certainly garners the attention or some of the attention beyond just the, you know, working with woodcock. And as Jerry pointed out, I mean, sometimes you are drawn into it from the bird dog side of things. And there's this really neat parallel where what makes a good woodcock banding dog very much translates to a lot of the things that we're looking for in a good bird hunting dog. But the primary motivation is the woodcock and the research, and obviously the safety and welfare of those birds, which is where this certification process comes in, and why we're not cutting pups loose and out there looking for chicks, and we're going through the certification process. So I think, Bailey, you mainly touched on it. As far as like a dog training side of things, you're looking for dogs that are, again, effectively steady to wing, shot, and fall because of the behavior that the hen woodcock will demonstrate. And sometimes she'll actually, maybe let's Bailey, what, walk us through like an encounter with a successful banding encounter. What does it look like from the time the dog goes on point to all the way through? Like, what steps are you doing, taking with the dog to effectively locate and band these birds?
Let her do that. But one of the it's a big deal. We mimic that flutter right. flight as best we can for these dogs. Well, and we attached a water bottle with about a, 15, 20-foot paracord to a pigeon. And believe it or not, it's pretty accurate because we don't know where that pigeon's going to go. And we've had it come right at the dog. We've had it literally sit down in front of the dog. So we put a lot of pressure on these dogs with this simulated flutter flight. And that's a big component that, you know, if your dog's wool broke, it's got to get through that. And that really is kind of the underlying, that's the gold standard right there. Because that kind of leads into, if your dog can't handle that, it can't handle what Bailey's going to talk yep. about. There you go. Sorry,
that's
Bailey.
That's great. Thanks. So, yeah, I'm happy to go through this knowing that it's different with every dog. I've got three certified dogs right now, and I banded over a few broods over each of them last year, and every encounter is different, but some things are more predictable than others. The Munsterlander gets me very, very much closer to the hen almost every time. I honestly think that he could probably point the chicks if I didn't pick him up and move him back, because he moves so slowly. And just like, I swear, I mean, I think he could do the whole thing if maybe I just had to put the band on, because he just seems to know the process so well after this long. And I mean, he's getting up there. He's 9 and a half now. So we've been doing this together for 8 years. And then my setter, that's 5 and a half, he points them from too far away. At first I thought it was going to be an issue, right? Like, I cannot find this perfectly camouflaged brood that, like, the hen will hold very, very tight, tighter than they ever hold in the fall when she's got a brood. Hey,
that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, a brood of chicks under her. And that behavior will change a little bit as the chicks become flighted. And it'll change a lot of it after the chicks are flighted, because they'll see you coming and they just explode like popcorn. But at first, they hold very tight. And yeah, so he's developed a very, very favorable method of relocation for me, because he'll, you know, I'll move him and he tracks alongside of me. And I only know that I'm really close when he, you know, I proceed ahead and he stays back. And then I know I'm close. But when I can't find them, it's stressful, because I know that I do not like putting extra stress on the birds. I like to get this process done as efficiently, but as quickly as possible, and get out of the woods so that the hen can get back with her brood, which is fine when you know, she's watching us approach. But he has developed a technique where he circles. If I'm not finding it, he'll just run like a circle around her and then point back towards me. And I know the distance between him and I, that the brood, like the hen will be right like halfway in between. It's insane. Yep. It's tough to describe. And then my younger setter, that was his first year last year. And most of the broods we ended up banding, which was great. He tracked from like the nest site right to the brood, which was really cool. But anyway, the dog points, you see the hen on the ground, and you pick the dog up and move it back to, you know, banding woodcock, we tend to be in some pretty young aspen or brush. And so you got to find like a sturdier tree that you can leash them to.
So do you always then tether the dog just for basically to control the situation?
You should. There are times when... and it should be a very short tether too, because the hen will buzz right over the tops of their heads. And if they can jump up,
right.
And they're, like I said, they're dogs after all. We have every different breed under the rainbow doing this. And some have a little higher prey drive for that type of behavior than others. And it is a lot about knowing your dog and being able to trust your dog. And then also knowing when you have some continuous improvement, things you need to work on, pull your dog out of the woods and work on some things with some other like pigeon demonstrations or things like that. Anyway, you should tether your dog up. There has been times when, you know, with like, you've done this almost 10 years and you have trustworthy dogs where you can just put them on like a sit, stay, or down. That's a rare scenario. But if I've had other people in the woods with me before, I have done that. But yes, so they're tethered to a tree, and you can safely work up the brood. You're gonna, we'll say in the scenario that the hen flushed and you know, she's milling around somewhere. I like to try to keep tabs on them. Sometimes they flush further than other times. Some birds flush further than others. Some seem like they, you know, they only go a short distance and they're probably watching you. Others come back and like they'll walk right up to you while you're working up the chicks and like basically demand that you give them back. It's every bird has a different behavior. And that's part of what makes this such a like unique experience that people are really obsessed with. And so you've got these banding bags, bird banding bags. So they're just cloth bags. And we're still practicing avian influenza protocol. So we need to, we'll take a GPS waypoint. We'll get out our cloth bags, put on our nitrile or latex gloves. And I like to identify as many of the chicks on the ground as possible before you start picking them up, because they'll let out an alert call. And as soon as they let out the alert call, the other ones will jump up and start running away. That behavior is very dependent on how old they are. But if they're more than like 2 or 3 days old, they usually do that. And so it's good to have them all identified where they are before you, well, I like to do it. I mean, pretty much before you take another step.
Yeah. And that's like, I want to touch on that, because it's been a while since I did go through the clinic, and I did some apprentice banding with Ty Sunny, and we banded a couple of broods. Ty and I went out one afternoon, and I got to see it all, so I have an idea, but I haven't done it nearly as much as Bailey has. But that's like basically you flush a hen, and you're standing there, and then it's sort of this like almost like this Where's Waldo, where you're looking for these tiny little chicks under a little bit of leaf litter. Like you might be standing there for minutes on end trying to identify these four chicks, right, Bailey?
Oh yeah. Yep, for sure. And that's the thing. I mean, in the fall or whenever you have a good point on a woodcock and you try to look for it on the ground, it's a great exercise even to find the adults. And I'd be lying if I said in the off season, I didn't look at some of my pictures where I know there's a brood on the ground and try to identify where all the chicks are, because it is so important. But it's just, it is very, like you said, Where's Waldo? It's very tough to see them on the forest floor. I mean, they are, they have evolved to blend in, and they've done a real good job of it. Yeah. And so identify as many as you can on the ground. There'll always be four or fewer. Ideally, you're going to see all four. And when they're younger, they will usually stick a little bit closer to mom. And as they get a little bit older, they might be spread out a little bit more. So it's definitely just critical that you have identified, if you can't find all four of them, that you've identified a safe place that you can put your gear and work up the ones that you do have. So you put them into the cloth banding bags, and then one at a time, they'll be pulled out and banded, and then their bill will be measured. We can age the chicks by the length of their bill. They're on average born with a 14 millimeter bill that grows 2 millimeters a day. So we can tell how many days old they are just by how long their bill is. And then we put them in another cloth bag, and then one at a time, we just kind of swap them over as we work them up, and then we release them. And in our handbook and during training, you'll learn the proper weather conditions for banding. So we never band when it's less than 45 degrees out. And then depending on the temperature of the day, we may have you like release your brood like in the sun, or we may have you release your brood in the shade. There's just varying factors. Well, we've tried to think of everything. And so varying factors, like the hen, you know, she may take up to a half an hour to return to her brood. And so if it's, you know, 45, you wouldn't want to put them in, which is the minimum temperature we allow for banding. You wouldn't want to put them in the shade if it was a sunny day. So
yes. So how often do you have a brood where you go in, say, flush a hen, and then you spot two or three, and if then you sort of make a move to grab those two to three birds, and then does the fourth one sort of expose itself by, because like they'll get up and walk, and like you said, if they make that alert call, then they can kind of be going all different directions. That's just, I imagine that's just something that it happens a little bit differently every time.
Yeah, it stresses me out. That's by far for me the most stressful part, is trying to find them all on the ground. And last year, because the weather conditions were so favorable for nesting, we had a really great hatch success. So I knew I should always be looking for four. And most of the time I found four. But there are some years where, you know, they'll lay one egg a day for 4 days, and then she'll begin incubating. So on those first day or two, if it's well below freezing at night, the egg could be not viable, and so only one or two eggs could hatch. And so her brood may only be one or two. So you drive yourself crazy sometimes thinking that there might be four out there. It is stressful, but it's just like something you got to gain experience with,
yep,
and just be confident with, that you did the best that you can. And then, like I said, just make sure you have a clear area to work in. And usually from where the hen flushes, and part of the study we were helping with the last few years, we need to be very confident in where the hen flushed, because we needed to collect a fecal sample from her and then from the brood as well, because we were seeing if, well, we aren't, but we're invested in this study, and that's why I find it to be so interesting. But what they were interested in studying at Kansas State was, you know, whether the chicks and the hens were eating the same or different things just by checking the insect DNA in their excrement. And so we needed to be really to pinpoint the location of her splash specifically compared to the chicks as we picked them up. And so usually your eyes on the ground and looking for that whitewash, and then kind of finding the chicks all around that area.
That's like another layer of compartmentalization as you're trying to take in this whole scene. You know, it's stressful already, and then you got to try to keep the poop separate.
That's right.
I was curious what the, because I know Eric, again, going back to last week's episode, Eric was talking about some genetic studies kind of trying to look at birds crossing over flyways and where is the genetic variation in woodcock in one area to another, but it sounds like this is more of a food base. What do the chicks, do they go to eating worms right away, or are they eating other stuff? What do you know about that, Bailey?
Yeah. So originally he wanted to know if what were woodcock eating in earthworm free areas in Minnesota. So earthworms are an invasive species. They weren't always here. Are there areas in the state that woodcock inhabit where there aren't earthworms? Turns out the answer is not really. There are earthworms everywhere now. But then the study morphed a little bit into a diet analysis of the chicks and the hens. Yes, they're eating worms pretty much as soon as they dry off and are out wandering around. So woodcock are precocial, unlike robins that need to be fed in the nest for a while. And you know, they're born like featherless. The woodcock are born with a downy layer of feathers, and they develop flight feathers by like, you know, 12 to 14 days they're flighted. So they develop extremely quick, and they need to eat a lot of food. So they're out feeding constantly. The results of this study is not out yet, but he did share a bit with us last year at our banding clinic, and it is interesting. I mean, it's a lot more stuff than just worms, different species in their larval stages, you know, that sort of look worm-like but aren't true worms.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to imagine they're a pretty opportunistic feeder and are going to be taking advantage of whatever they can find.
No biology questions for me, Nick, or what?
Sorry, Jared.
We're getting to that. We're getting to that.
No, I'm kidding. It is fascinating, and it is. That's why it's cool to have friends like that, because you learn so much.
Yeah.
You know, like the fecal study, I mean, a lot of invertebrates and spiders and little stuff that you wouldn't think of. And well, and two, didn't you guys do this? Like it was trying to see what they eat, like these males are coming up right now, and, you know, the earthworms aren't moving around real much with the frost and the snow. But, you know, every little bit helps, you know, every little bit helps.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I've been so stressed about when they come up and then it gets all frozen. But just got to trust the process.
Oh, seriously, yeah.
Well, and that was the other thing that I asked Eric about that too. And he said, at least from the GPS studies, you know, they didn't see a lot of regression. Like when the woodcock show up, it's not like they just pick up and fly 100 miles south. Like, it's not like they can't do that. I think we've all kind of seen enough to know that they do move around, but they must have some sort of plan. You know, they kind of follow that. It seems to me that they follow that snow line, and if there's no snow, they just kind of keep scooting along to the north. And there's probably, I think what Eric was pointing out, you know, there's sure the ground may be frozen here, but you know, maybe there's a creek bed or something somewhere where the ground is softened up and they can get underneath it, and obviously they can get their nutrition in many ways.
I know we helped with the GPS survey, God, probably 6-7 years ago with Dave Kremitz and Tom Cooper and Dave Anderson at the U. And it was really interesting too, again, how, I mean, they had 75 birds they banded at Four Brooks, and the data points and all the information they got from that before the one that Eric did. It's so important that we're starting, because of the GPS, starting to figure out not so much their core habitat, but their migration habitat in Iowa, Missouri, you know, mm-hmm. we're on their way back, what they need for habitat on the way back too. So it looks like a lot of that research is coming to fruition to try to do some habitat projects. I know with Kyle and the feds and maybe RGS too, about their migration habitat versus their regular winter, or excuse me, fall summer habitat.
That actually reminds me, I was going to ask you earlier, Bailey, I don't know if this is really relevant, but the difference between the state permit, when you guys were working under the state permit, and the federal permit, is the permit, you know, obviously I imagine the permit is sort of all encompassing as far as being able to work with wildlife on certain properties, but what were there other differences between like a state permit versus a federal permit? I guess didn't know anything walking into it, I would assume it would be more of like a federal permit thing, just because it's like a federally regulated bird. And
yeah, thanks for letting me clarify that. That's true. So we fell under this Minnesota DNRs. They oversaw the banding program prior to us receiving our own federal permit. Woodcock, all ducks and geese, you know, we as a state DNR banned quite a few ducks and geese every year. That is also under a federal permit from the same bird banding lab that we have our, and the same thing that, you know, like Hawk Ridge here in Duluth, or Sugarloaf up the shore, any place that bans migratory birds there that are under federal protection under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, you have to have a federal permit to ban. And so the Minnesota DNR has a federal permit to ban ducks and geese already. So we were just kind of an annoying group of people that fell under their permit. And so now we just, you know, received our own. And people who have the set of skills to band can get their own permit to band, you know, like chickadees in their backyard or something. If they can prove to the banding lab that they have that set of skills and a purpose for doing so. Yeah.
All right. So I want to cover some basics as far as like the banding program, and we'll start with who can band, like who is eligible to attend one of these workshops and go out and band?
Anybody. We've had people come through the clinic and the program without a dog. They just love nature. They love birding. They love birds, and they want to know more about the woodcock in general. So we've had people kind of just come and watch and learn, take it all in. Primarily, we want dog people with really damn good dogs. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And Bailey makes it sound easy that you go out there and you find a brood. I mean, we've had apprentices take 3-4 years before they could band a brood. It's not as easy as Bailey and some of our other mentors make it sound, but really anybody that's got a great attitude wants to be in the woods in the spring and have and for the right reasons, and we've had a lot of great people come through the program.
Yeah, ideally,
the biggest thing is having a good bird dog.
Yeah, so like Jerry said, ideally we'll have people with already trained dogs. If you want to attend the workshop and you think your dog is ready, by all means, sign up. And if they're not, we will work with you. It doesn't mean you have to, like, you can't be a Woodcock Bander. If you're passionate about it and you put the work in to get your dog to that level, you keep coming back time after time, and then you are committed enough to go through the apprenticeship after working through, the dog thing, then by all means, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, I get to be the bad guy, and it happens every once in a while, saying, hey, your dog's not ready. This is what we would recommend you do. And if you do that, you drive up and see me at Pine Ridge. We'll put you through the test. And if it checks out and it works good, it could be in July we'll pass you. If you put the work in and the dog is steady, like we require it to be, and then you can be on an apprenticeship for next spring. We're pretty, I don't want to say we're pretty tough on that. And again, we've had people come up, like Bailey said, that dogs they think it's ready, and there's different levels of what wool means to people, and it's really evident when you do this type of process. And we'll help them and help give them some pointers. They'll come back in 2 months and the dog is awesome. And you know what? All right, we'll run it through a test. We'll run it through two tests. We'll say, Bep, this dog is checked out and it can be go with a mentor next year. So, we want people to succeed. We're going to be pretty stringent on that one requirement, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and again, it makes a ton of sense. You think about it's all for the safety and welfare of the birds, but I could, again, speak from my own experience that, if you're passionate and you're there for the right reasons, there's a ton of people that are willing to help you figure it out. And that's ultimately the goal of the program. So we've talked quite a bit about it, but
go ahead. Can I just say one more thing, Nick? I think this is a great program for women to get involved. I think the last couple of years, Bailey, we've been with 50% women in the program, haven't we? And it's a great way for them to come into really just a really good atmosphere with like-minded people, men and women, to run their dogs and get some. And it's a really good entry point, I think, for people, women, to get involved in hunting, take it that next step that next fall too. And we've seen that a little bit with some of the people that have come in. We've also had a lot of younger people come with a mentor, kids in high school. That's been kind of a cool little thing for us too, to help them and maybe spark a little passion on dog training, or especially woodcock and grouse and woodcock hunting. But it's a great entry point for people to get involved in more of the outdoors and with their bird dog.
Yeah, especially from a wildlife perspective and a bird. I mean, who doesn't like to watch a bird dog do what it's bred to do? And this is just it's different. It's not hunting season, and there are some neat differences about it. It allows you to focus on different aspects of the birds and the dogs, which is really neat. And yeah, like you said, it's got the wheels turning for me thinking about my older boy. He's 6 now and loves to tag along in the woods. So I emailed Kyle earlier this week to figure out if I was still on the permit, 'cause I'm thinking it would be a neat activity to bring Hunter out there and see if we could find some broods. And again, yeah, I think the apprenticeship side of things, again, going through it, like that's a critical component. You don't just go through the course and you're cut loose, because there is, like, I remember when you go out there, like, you, as much as somebody could describe, yeah, you need to look around and try to find these birds, it was very, very helpful to have somebody that had done it before to sort of walk you through that. And Bailey, you commented on kind of the stressful scenario, like, you can put a lot of pressure on yourself to try to do this right because you want to. So having somebody else there to help you out in some of those early, those first broods, I think, is a critical component to the whole thing.
It's definitely something that you can't know everything about.
Right.
I've been doing it for a while now, and I feel like every time I encounter a scenario where I what you know, found something unexpected happen. I feel like I know so much less than that I know. I feel like I know nothing, or there's still so much to learn. Even though most of the time the process is fairly predictable.
So is the clinic still is it a 2-day, like 1-day education and then 1-day dog certification? How does it lay out now?
It's a Thursday night meet and greet by the campfire. And that's kind of really, I don't know, I'm biased, but I think that's a big deal because everybody, you know, you get to know everybody a little bit and you're sitting by the fire having a beer. The classroom is about, we kind of break it up with, if we've got some experienced people that have already gone through the program, we'll get them all banding right away. But it is about a day, about a half a day classroom, half a day classroom. We'll go out and get these, kind of rotate a little bit and get these dogs certified if we can, and have them get out with the mentor. Last couple of years, it's been kind of based on weather, kind of the strategy, but it's really a Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning program. When everybody gets out of here, if they want to band on Sunday, we've got a couple, you know, mentors that are hanging out here for a while, Steven for one and Debbie. So they'll band right up until Sunday night, but arrive Thursday night, hang out Friday, Saturday, leave Sunday noon.
Yeah, we usually try to buy some like day old chicks or quail chicks. Yep. And when we have half the group testing out dogs, we'll run the other half through some practice banding scenarios. You never want the first time you need to try to remove a band to be on a woodcock. I've never had to remove a band from a woodcock. I've had to from geese, but that band's quite a bit larger. But it is a very stressful scenario. And so to get those kinds of skills that for those situations.
And how to hold
it. Yeah, definitely how to hold the chick
too.
The first time holding the band in your hand, it's a very small band. Woodcock's legs don't grow that much after they're born, and not enough so that the band itself wouldn't slip above the knee joint or below the like ankle joint. So that we can really band that's woodcock are a little bit different because you can band them pretty much from as soon as they dry off and are.
Yeah, it's what allows it to work
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. And so it's just critical that we practice that kind of thing because just opening the band, I can't tell you how many first time band. Okay, I will. Almost every time somebody puts the band on the banding pliers, they fling that thing across the room and you don't want them to be on the forest floor because good luck finding it. And right. We have to account for every single band. So like if our program sounds strict, like it is because, you know, we're under watchful eye from the bird banding lab and everything needs to be accounted for in every way.
What other on that note?
Plus, we do a little sky dance too, Nick. We do a little sky dance at night with the woodcock on the resident birds here.
Yeah, that's where, again, Pine Ridge works out because you really have it all. You got woodcock sky dancing out on the field there. You can do all the dog training stuff. And then you are perfectly positioned to send new banders out with apprentices and hit the adjacent public lands and go find some broods.
Yeah. So it works out pretty good.
What other equipment from an equipment perspective? Obviously, you've got like, you know, we don't need to get into like, you know, you're going out in the woods and most of us listening here are bird hunters and we have dogs. So we have that sort of stuff. But woodcock banding specific equipment. I know there's sort of a special pliers that you're using. Bailey, you mentioned the bag that you're collecting. Earl had a funny thing about, he called it like it was like for his negligees or like
different bags now. But the woodcock banding pliers, which Earl made for almost everybody in the program, and that it's really important to have the perfect size pliers to close these bands so that you never have to worry about opening them. These are aluminum bands. They're small enough already because they have how many digits is that number? 9? I'm going to say 9. I could be wrong. But there's
it's a tiny little band.
Yeah, the identifier, the number that's on the band, plus how, then it also says the reportband.gov website on there. It used to be a phone number for calling it in. So it's a lot of information on a really small little piece of aluminum that needs to be strong enough that it doesn't, completely wear or fall off or something. And it's critical that that gets closed, you know, very nicely, neatly, so that the ends are touching. And so if you have the right size banding pliers, that should ensure that that never happens. And so the proper banding pliers and then the miniature ruler so we can get the bill measurements. GPS is critical for the data sheets and then for, you know, potentially future like habitat measurements or something like that should we go back there. But that each waypoint gets entered so that we can identify if a banded bird gets harvested, how far away from where it was banded did it get harvested. What else? You know, just your general dog first aid kit. The spring woods are dry and you're running in young aspen. Typically, I have had one or two dogs rip pads every season now. It really stinks. So just running on slash, it's bound to happen, though, in the woods. Or so I carry a booty and some first aid stuff, else, compass, snacks, water, lots of water.
Yeah, I was going to ask the net and how, because there is, you sometimes, I don't, and you could speak to this, Bailey, but that's like, if you are able to catch the hen, you could also put a band on the hen, but oftentimes the hen is harder to catch and often not caught. So a lot of times you end up just banding chicks, correct?
Correct. We are still permitted to catch hens. That could change, but for now we still are. We don't. It's a very special circumstance that you're able to, and you have to have a good amount of banding experience prior to being able to even attempt to do that. And then, but when the chicks are starting to, you can tell when they start to look like ugly teenagers, is what I call that stage where they're kind of goofy looking and mostly feathered, but they still have kind of a downy head, you can just very gently place the net over those before they flush or attempt to flush. And that way you can get, you know, a bird banded that way. And so later in the banding season, I mean, I talk about catching or banding all four, but that's like ideally, you know, the first 10 days of their life, you can easily do that. But after 10 days, between 10 and 14 days, you're lucky to get a couple before they kind of popcorn out of there. And this is not like we're not swinging it around like a butterfly net. This is very gently placing. We all have kind of homemade nets based on what we've kind of found has worked throughout the years. We actually have a bander now who is like working on 3D printing nets for us. So we all kind of have uniform ones that we can fold up and put in our vest. No more.
Oh, wow.
Long gone is the day of Earl's walking stick net that he used.
Exactly.
But that's sort of the process. Just being like just gently placing them over the nearly flighted chicks so that we can they don't have such a they're only kind of flushing into the net, I guess. But sometimes that is way more work than it's worth to carry a net around in the woods with you because it is gets hung up on everything. And last year, just a quick story. I do carry bear spray with me, and I made the bad mistake of not having a bell on my dog in the springtime. And it was pretty green in a really dense stand, and Mogul was pointing a sow with cubs.
Oh boy.
And she came charging at me, and I was holding my net in my hand, and I had that was where my bear spray was on that side of my vest. And so I did not have enough time to reach back and grab it. And so I was like, well, this net is going to do almost nothing, but that's pretty much the only thing I held out was my net. And then I yelled at her and I got the dog.
Did Mogul stay steady?
Yeah, so here's the thing. What kind of German dog doesn't bark at bird game? He just was pointing the whole time. And then so I was able to back away from her as she stood on a tipped over log and snapped her teeth at me. I mean, she came within 4 or 5 feet of me.
Oh my
gosh. Very frightening.
That's intense.
I was able to back away 10 yards, and then, but I didn't the cover was, like I said, was so thick. I couldn't go through it to get to Mogul. So I started to call him. And then the cubs came running out towards me and they ran past her. And I was like, crud, they're going to, like, she's going to chase after me again. And then I was like, I was able to grab my bear spray by then, but then I was able to get him to me.
You said crud. That's exactly yeah. what you said. Crud.
That's what right? I said.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, man. That's intense.
A bell is good to carry. Bear spray is good to carry. And in that yep. situation, having the net in my hand was not necessarily the best choice.
Oh, man. All right. What about just a couple more here and we'll close this one up. But anecdotally, like from a brood density, I'm just wondering like how you go about it. Like if you go out into a cover and you band a brood, do you just kind of keep on going looking for another brood? Are you more likely to circle back to the truck, go to a different spot? Like how do you think about that?
It totally depends on the cover, the size of the yeah. cover, and you know, how many maybe like openings or likely areas for nesting would be in there. There are covers that have certainly the potential to hold multiple broods. Mm-hmm. The larger they are, the more likely that they are. And sometimes I've been avoiding a known like nest location. I hate finding nests. I try to, as soon as the woodcock are
bad. You're saying like with eggs in them and not
yeah,
chicks.
Correct. Yeah. yeah. So I just, my presence in the location of a nest just means that there's, you know, scent heading towards that.
Right.
Everything likes eggs, right? And so I just feel like my scent and the dog's scent being in that area is not good. And we have this covered in our handbook as well. We never want to dead end at like a nest. You want to continue in like a straight line past it so a predator would follow your scent versus turning towards the woodcock. They're very,
yep.
very good at keeping scent away from their nest. It's not every dog that can find a hen on a nest. And that's a good thing because, like I said, you just don't want to draw a lot of scent towards that nest. Anyway, so I had some locations where I knew where a nest was and I was avoiding it and happened to find like a brood that way. And that has happened, a few times in larger, very quality covers. But I have some covers that I find, like I found three broods in last year. That was probably one of my better spots. But most often, just because of the abundance of available covers to check here, we have like more covers to check than we have time.
Right.
It's such a short window that the banding season is. And so I think it tends to be one or two. But they're not super competitive for nest selection. I don't think I've found nests like 10 yards apart before, or I should say like the remnants of nests like 10 yards apart
yeah.
before. So crazy.
All right, Jerry, what are the dates and potential availability for the Minnesota workshop this year? Do you have them?
Dates.
Your website's not updated.
It says
2023.
It just depends on where you, the landing page you go to.
Okay.
Yeah. So Wisconsin is the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, correct, Barry? Sold spring?
We don't have this. Oh, do we have it reserved? It's written 10th through 12th, so we'll be starting early Friday
10th
morning.
10th through 12th, yep. And Pine Ridge is the 16th through the 19th. It is on the Pine Ridge page. I'll go check the date on it and I know I've updated, but been a little.
I might have just Googled my way to last year's page or something.
Yeah, probably. I'll blame it on that. But email me at grousecamp@gmail.com or give me a call. Shoot me an email, Bailey an email, and we can answer any questions that way. We do have room for the Minnesota one still.
Okay.
Couple spots away. Give us a call. Or email.
Bailey, what's the venue for the Wisconsin one? You mentioned Solon Springs, man. But where is it? Where is it at? Do you know?
So that was really tough. There's no other Pine Ridge. So unfortunately, it was tough to find something that had everything that we needed. We need space to run the dog test. Camping was desirable for a lot of folks. And then lodging nearby. Lodging on site would have been great. And then a facility to hold 20 people for
the seminar part.
Yeah, for the lecture part and then the kind of hands-on portion. And so we settled on the Douglas County Wildlife Area. It's a like a former dog trialing site. And they have a clubhouse. It's beautiful. They have camping on site. And then we were able to get permitted to do the dog testing there. And you know, there is an active sharp-tailed lek on that unit, but we're not going to be anywhere near that. So kind of excited to see that site. There's lodging within like 3 or 4 miles that we have booked for that. But there are some difficulties and logistics that we're working through banding in Wisconsin for the first time. And so we may end up having to have the program there in Solon Springs and then driving into Minnesota to band, which is a little goofy, but we're, like I said, we're working through some logistical issues and we're, you know, just trying to find a permanent home for the program in Wisconsin. It's just a kind of a different state for us compared to the way the rules work here in Minnesota that we're just kind of navigating around some issues right now, but hopefully everything will be running smooth by the clinic.
Sounds good. Moving in the right direction. And for all those that I've definitely been asked before, but all those interested in Wisconsin banding, progress is being made there. And there's some opportunity opening up. So good to share that here. All right. Anything else that we missed or you feel we need to share, Jerry?
I think my friend Bailey said it all and said it perfectly.
Wonderful. Bailey, I know you're the dogs are eager to go out and play in the snow. I think mine are too. So any final thoughts?
Yeah, AJ must be done snow plowing or something.
He hasn't fallen off the roof yet, has he?
No, I've been listening attentively. I don't think so. I mean, I could easily probably talk about Woodcock for another several hours and I won't do that to you. So just reach out if you have any questions, I guess.
All right.
There is a Woodcock, Minnesota Instagram and Facebook page do have flyers posted for both the events. My email address is on that for the Wisconsin one. Jerry's handling registrations for Minnesota.
They call him the president, don't they?
Yeah. Prez.
Yeah.
State of the Union here
of
with
a third world country.
Yes. All right. Well,
yeah, exactly.
That is a wrap. Everybody, think spring. We got our much needed precipitation in the form of a whole bunch of snow, and that will be melting soon. And soon enough, we will be out in the banding woods. So thanks to both of you for coming on and sharing all of that information with the listeners. Two of you, hang on with me for just a minute, and that does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.